Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello there and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. Hope you're well. Hope you've had a good summer. Of course, you've been listening to the Arsecast Extra, which we've kept going for the most part throughout the summer, but the Arsecast itself goes on hiatus during the off-season, but we're back. This is episode 433, a bit like episodes 352 and 343 before it, an actual football formation. Whoa! I hope we're still here at episode 3142, but you know, given the way the news is going, by the time this one goes out, we could all be dust. Anyway, we're back because the new season, well, it's here. It's right on top of us. It's starting, well, tonight. I was going to say this weekend, but tonight, Friday. Friday Night Lights. Clear eyes. Full arse. Can't lose. You know what I'm talking about. Friday night, though, that's weird, isn't it? You know, when you think about the start of a new season, you think about the first Saturday. You think about a sunny day, a 3 o'clock kickoff. It's August. It's still summer. The sun is shining. The shadows are on the pitch. People are in their shirt sleeves. But no, we're not getting that. We're getting a Friday night kickoff against Leicester. And if that doesn't quite sum up what this season is going to bring for us, in terms of podcasting at least, well, nothing else will. Because, well, we're in the Europa League. That means no football on a Tuesday night, no European football on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night. It's going to be Thursday night. Thursday night football, which means for the Arsecast that goes out on a Friday, well, you know, we're not going to be able to do something unless I stay up really late at night, which I'm not going to do. I'm just going to throw that right out there. I am not staying awake until 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning to record a podcast. So what we might have this season are certain podcasts, certain Arsecasts going out on a Saturday or maybe on a Friday afternoon rather than a Friday morning. We'll try and minimize the disruption as much as we can, but, you know, I don't know how it's all going to go. I've never experienced a podcasting season with a Europa League season before. It's all new to me. So, you know, as ever, we will make it up as we go along, but I'm sure it'll be fine. We'll cope, we'll manage, as we always do. So, what is the new season going to hold for Arsenal? It's a long, challenging, treacherous, difficult road. There will be ups, there will be downs, there will be sidewayses, some diagonally bits as well. I don't know, but here we are. You know, I said it on the Arsecast Extra on Monday. Every time the new season begins, I'm filled with this childlike optimism that Arsenal can go on and do something amazing just because they're Arsenal. I have this sort of weird faith in the institution of Arsenal itself. And I know, I understand, I realize I'm a sensible person. I've been writing about Arsenal for over 15 years. I get it. I know that it doesn't always work out like that, but it's still there, that little part of me that just believes. It has this belief that Arsenal can go and do something crazy like, you know, win the league. It's there right now. And, you know, the other part of my head is going, shut up. Come on, just don't get yourself all wound up like this. Don't set yourself up for a fall, you lunatic. What are you like? You know better than this. And the higher you set yourself up from to believe in the thing that you know probably won't happen, the further you'll fall, and you'll fall on your head. And your head has already sustained a number of serious blows throughout your life, which would explain many things. You don't need another blow to the head, but look, I just can't help it. It's there, it's in me. Like the alien inside John Hurt in that movie about the alien that bursts out of John Hurt's stomach and the alien runs around the spaceship. I think it's called Tummy Twat or something like that. Anyway, we are going to preview the brand new season, not just from an Arsenal point of view, but we're going to talk about the season in general, what lies ahead for all the big clubs in the Premier League. We're going to talk about the transfer market. We're going to talk about how crazy it's gone. Who's spending? Who's not spending? Why aren't they spending? How much are they spending? They're spending that much on that? What the hell's going on? It's hard to make sense of the transfer market. We'll talk about the difficulties, perhaps, of selling players. And as ever, I'm joined by Ken Early from Second Captains, and also joining myself and Ken, chief sports writer from Joe Dion Fanning. So we're probably just going to get on with it, because this is a fairly lengthy chat, a fairly lengthy podcast, so we better whack into it without too much of my waffle and meanderings. But towards the end, we will come back and just give a little bit of team news ahead of the Leicester game tonight, Friday fucking night football. It is what it is, and we have got to get on with it. So without further ado, this is the first Arsecast of the brand new season. Catch you on the far side. Enjoy. All right, with me now to discuss the start of a new Premier League season, I'm delighted to welcome back, as always, on the eve of a new season, from Second Captains, Ken Early. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I am all right. And also joining us this season, sports writer with Joe, it's Dion Fanning. Hi there.
Hey, Andrew. How's it going?
It's going all right. So, look, I think the first thing we should start to talk about, given that it's summer and it's the thing that people are concerned about the most, is transfers. And we saw the world transfer record broken, Ken. Neymar has gone from Barcelona to PSG, and it's something that you've not taken against, I guess, but you've got a fairly different view on it from many people, that you feel like Neymar's taken a step down, that this is a move that he's made only for the money. I think that's a point of view people can see, but you kind of want him to own that.
Do many people disagree that it's a step down?
I don't know.
It's obviously a step down.
Well, yeah, I think, what was the line that you wrote in the article? That players have left Monaco to go play in serious leagues, whereas Liga is not.
No, it's a joke. He's like, there's no. It means that there's most of his season is irrelevant. Mm. It's all about the Champions League. I mean, you could say this. Well, he's still in the Champions League, but the Champions League doesn't happen very often. You know, football is a game that you play every week. It's not, you know, it's not like the sort of. I mean, even the NFL has twice as many games, you know, as the Champions League, and we're talking, and they cram it all into less than half a year. I mean, I keep hearing, say, for instance, people talk about some guy called Kyrie Irving. Now, I haven't got a fucking clue who Kyrie Irving is, but like, I looked him up, and he's some basketball player, and he's. He plays for the Cavaliers,
right?
And he's annoyed because LeBron James is like getting paid more, or is more famous, or is better than him, or whatever. So he wants to go somewhere where he can be the main man, the franchise player. And yeah, well, why isn't that like Neymar? And the difference is that Kyrie Irving will still be playing in the NBA. I mean, if Neymar was to accept, or if it's like if he, the Neymar situation is equivalent to him accepting, that is Kyrie Irving accepting, you know, a contract to go and play for Real Madrid in the Spanish Basketball League. That's what Neymar's done, just because he's getting, you know, more money than anybody else is going to get. You know, he's already getting more money than almost everybody, and he wants more. And I just find it remarkable that a player that good would be that willing to step away from the highest level of the sport that he could compete in.
Well, I mean, Dion, is that not what footballers have done all the time? They've moved for money. Obviously, there are sporting challenges, and I can, you know, see the point that in terms of European leagues, the French league is probably the fifth.
It's fifth by miles. It's much closer to the sixth than it is to the fourth, which is Italy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you look at the coefficients, it's like closer to Belgium and Ukraine than it is to Italy and Germany.
Yeah.
I mean, the coefficients, you know, whatever they mean, but the fact is, it's not a league historically that anybody outside France has paid any attention to, and it's, you know, it's a league that the, if you look at the French national team, most of them play abroad. They don't play at home because they know that this isn't the place to play.
Dion, what about the argument that Neymar's gone there to maybe be the start of something at PSG? To obviously, I think it was Rory Smith talking, could have been on your podcast, Ken, on Second Captains, perhaps, or maybe radio show anyway, but he was talking about how PSG want to be the first big club of the digital era. They're obviously a relatively young club in terms of their history. It was only set up in the 1960s, but they obviously have this money, this Qatari wealth fund behind them, that in order then to build this I guess, franchise into something remarkable, they need to make a big signing like Neymar. So you can see it from the PSG
I can see it from their. I can see it from their point of view. I can see it from the point of view of. I can just about see it from the point of view of this idea of Qatar using it as a sort of to advance their sort of soft power in the world. But I even find that, like, there's been a lot of stuff saying this is how they will, you know, improve their image around the world. I kind of think ultimately, though, being the club, being a country that owns a club that owns Neymar, isn't really going to count for much in the soft power world if you're kind of sponsoring terrorism and, you know, have sort of migrant workers dying while you're building a World Cup stadium. So, like, I don't see how that works either. Mm. From his point of view, I'm sure he can believe it's a project. I think people have done this before. I think you know, there's a view in England that players have stayed in Spain rather than gone to England, have gone to the Premier League because it's an easier league to play in to win individual honours because you don't have you've got a competitive league, you know, in the top, you know, three or four teams, but you don't have the drudgery of the English Premier League. And, you know, I think Manchester United, Manchester City put this out that was one of the reasons they found it hard to attract certain players as well. So maybe Neymar is just taking that to the next step and thinking, in this league where I'm going to be by far the biggest star, all the individual honours are going to come to me. Now, again, that's to kind of agree with Ken to an extent that it is about promoting himself and making money, making himself the biggest name in the world. Although it was kind of working out quite well for him as a global superstar at Barcelona in the, you know, the greatest front line in the game. Mm. So you could see it from the other point of view as well. But I think people have done it. Like, you know, Kevin Keegan joined Southampton. He was a bit older. He was like 29. Kevin Keegan joined Southampton when he was European Player of the Year. Except that he was going into the English First Division. Mm. But he was joining a club that people wondered what he was doing, going there.
Yeah. Mm. But I mean, is there something fundamentally wrong with a player who has a short career making a decision based on that and going for the money, because players move for money all the time? What makes his situation that much different from a guy who comes from Liga to go to the Premier League?
Like, you know, that guy who's at Michu or something. I mean, Neymar's one of the best players in the world. That's mm-hmm. the difference. Neymar is, you know, supposedly the next, you know, when Messi's retired, he will be the best player. Mm. And he's already the third best player in the world. Maybe Tevez is up there now. But
in terms of paid,
yeah, like $37 million the last time Forbes estimated his earnings. So he's already making an enormous amount of money. So the marginal sort of you're into diminishing marginal returns money-wise, at least you would have thought you could afford to think about other things, such as, do I, as the best player in the world, have a responsibility to play at the highest level that I can play at? Do I have a responsibility to my own talent to maximize that? Can I afford to think about anything other than money? Or do I have to do whatever Qatar wants me to do because of the fact that they're really rich? Hmm. I find it depressing that he just, oh, okay. You know, that even a talent like that can be just bought. Even somebody so wealthy can be bought, can be controlled by money. And also the fact that so many people think that this is normal. That just Qatar say, oh, you know, move here. Moving people around like pawns on a board just because they're really rich. I mean, the difference with Neymar is that the marginal... I mean, say when Michu went to Swansea, what was he getting paid in La Liga before? Like, yeah, 150 grand? I don't know. I mean, he's making 10 times his money. But he's also moving to play at a decent level. Players who go to China, for instance, I mean, say Oscar got tired of the Chelsea bench. I mean, Oscar's a pretty high-level player, but, you know, he's not Neymar. You know, if Oscar had the opportunity to go to Barcelona for half the money, where do you think he would have gone? I mean, Neymar had a position in the game that everybody else envied, and he gave that up just because he wanted to make more. And to me, that says, here's a guy who doesn't care about the game. He actually doesn't care.
But isn't that comparative, too? Like, Oscar is going to China because that's the best financial offer available to him.
Hmm.
But
look at what he's given up. Sitting on the Chelsea bench.
Yeah, but
he's not. Do you think Suarez would go to PSG?
No, I don't. But why is that?
Because he cares about the game.
But if you're living in a world where Oscar is going to China, Neymar might think that this is going to PSG is not it's not that unusual. If people, you know, if people around him are doing things like saying, "I'm off to China for a year or two," and you know, I've heard this from like people, you know, from dressing rooms in England when the China thing exploded. Everything, the only topic of conversation in Premier League dressing rooms was China and the money they're paying.
Mm.
So it is it quite literally changes the conversation.
Mm.
So if you're Neymar and you're seeing this, you think, well, PSG isn't China. Mm. I'm still in the game. I'm still going to win the Champions League.
Mm.
I agree with you. I think the Champions League, especially the way it's become and it's turned into such a dud tournament that only comes alive in the kind of quarterfinal stages, basically. Mm. It doesn't seem like an awful lot to be kind of waiting for every season.
I would compare it to, say, for instance, what happens when the money started coming into English football. I mean, remember during the sort of 80s, especially after the European ban, English or, you know, British players were, you know, even Mick McCarthy was at Lyon, Kevin Moran was at, like, Sporting Gijon.
Mm.
You know, players were going to play in France, Italy. You know, all the best players would leave because the money was better elsewhere. Now, when that started to change after the Sky deal, after the formation of the Premier League, what did you see? You didn't see the best players in Italy and Spain leaving. You know, you didn't see Roberto Baggio going, oh, you know, it turns out I can make a ton of money playing for some crowd called Chelsea. You know, I'll be straight off there. It wasn't those players. It was guys like Hullet, Klinsmann, Viali, who were
end of career.
They were past their best. They were like the players who go to America now, or you know, the players, most of the players who are going to China. You know, they
there was a tipping point as well.
There was a tipping point, but only after a few years of this process, when you could look at the league and go, actually, you know, this is a pretty good league. Like, these teams are doing well. Manchester United won the Champions League. You know, they were constantly in the latter stage. It was clearly a good league.
Like, and Bergkamp, that was when Bergkamp went to Arsenal. That was before, you know, that was
Bergkamp went to Arsenal because he'd originally gone to Inter, which was the proper league, and had an absolute nightmare there. He had a complete nightmare. I mean, he was just desperate to get out. He nearly went to Aston Villa. Bergkamp was prepared to join Aston Villa. That is how desperate he was to escape from Inter. So you're always going to get these cases. The case of Neymar is not the same. Neymar is the you know, the top player in the league, bar Messi and Ronaldo, the top player in the world, playing for in the most enviable team setup, and he just throws it all away. It's crazy.
But you talk about the way it happened, and from you could correct me if I'm wrong here, but the way it happened seems to be that Qatar have made Neymar an ambassador, paid him a huge amount of money, which he then pays to Barcelona to buy out his own contract, and then keeps the rest as his salary and signing on fee. I mean, as people who try and understand the game and try and understand football to a certain extent and how football clubs can operate and deal in the transfer market, this seems an extraordinary departure.
It almost would be enough to make you suspect that the whole sort of financial and legal system is something created by really rich people to enable them to do whatever they want. you would almost look at that and think, how can this be legal? I mean, where is the income tax on this due? You know, Neymar's just, you know, what's actually going on here? But if you've got enough money, you can get away with whatever you want to do.
Dion, it also is going to have an effect, I think, on the transfer market in general, because it becomes, whether people like it or not, it becomes a benchmark that all of a sudden this is the highest transfer fee ever paid. Therefore, everything else exponentially is judged off that. So a player who's a quarter as good as Neymar might be seen to be a £50 million player. I mean,
Kyle Walker.
Well, that's what I was going to say. We saw it with Kyle Walker, like £50 million. He's the most expensive defender in the world. And, like, he's very good at running.
Yeah.
But is that what £50 million gets you now? I mean, how do we try and make any sense of the transfer market anymore? Is it even possible to try and put a value on a player based on what we've seen?
Well, it doesn't make sense if you look at what's happened with TV, you know, TV viewing figures and all that kind of stuff over the last year. But every football club is basing it on the idea that when the next rights are negotiated, I think it's next year, isn't it? Like, it's early next year.
They'll be negotiating them. Yeah.
And, you know,
because they're in the second year now of this current deal. Yeah.
And Amazon are going to come to the, they think there's already talking, you know, Amazon have bought, some tennis rights, didn't they? They've bought some tennis.
Right.
And there's talk that Amazon will come, Google might come. So they're basing it on the fact that even if the TV money goes, other money is going to come in. Because otherwise it is a bubble. Like, people say the market will take care of itself and all that. But that's what people always say about bubbles. Like, and a bubble is only a bubble when the underlying structures turn out to actually not have been as secure as you thought they were. And at the moment, it would look like, with the TV watching in the kind of precarious position that it's in, you would think, actually, this does look like a bubble.
Mm.
And if you're spending $50 million on Kyle Walker, that's another sign of a bubble.
Mm.
But I suppose if you're betting on someone like Amazon coming to the table and ensuring the revenue keeps coming in, then you'll think this is okay, this is sustainable.
But doesn't the threat of Amazon and those companies, streaming companies, people who we don't expect, these new platforms that we haven't been aware of, does that not then drive the likes of Sky and BT to increase their offers to keep them away?
I was reading about a guy who's just left BT, who was a big supporter, who was a driver in the kind of spending ridiculous money on the Champions League rights, which again makes no sense when you think of the attraction of the Champions League.
Mm.
The money BT spent on it was crazy.
Mm.
The guy who drove that, or one of the allies of the guy who drove it, just left last week, and somebody else who may or may not be as gung-ho about sports rights has now come into that job. So it doesn't take much for one person to say, well, we're not going to bid. And Sky, as Richard Keys, Sky have done their money, as Richard Keys famously said. Like, they've... They spent so much the last time. It is going to be interesting to see what they'll do now. And maybe they'll be prompted by that. Maybe they'll say, "Well, we'll cut back." Who knows? But there's enough uncertainty there for you to say, "Well, is this the time to be spending $50 million on Kyle Walker? Is this the time to?"
Well, the City are a different case, aren't they?
Yeah, well, City are a different case, but
City are more the Paris.
Yeah, there is but. Eric Dier. If Eric Dier had gone for $50 million, that was my. I would have taken that as a sign to take your money out of the bank and put it under the mattress. Because here comes the crash.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen. So maybe we're all going to be safe for a while longer.
In some ways as well, it creates a bit of a problem. Arsene Wenger. I don't know if you've seen it yet this morning, he was talking about how there's congestion in the market. Arsenal have a lot of players that they've got to move on this summer. There's a lot of players who aren't wanted, who aren't needed, who are in the final years of their contracts, etc., etc. But the money that's in the Premier League, the level of the players that's in the Premier League as well, have they made this, when we talk about bubbles, have they created a bubble in which you can only sell Premier League players to other Premier League clubs unless those players are willing to take substantial cuts and the clubs are willing to take much less than a player would be worth? So, for example, if a player at Arsenal wants to go to a club in France, they're not going to pay what Swansea or
with one exception. I mean, I can think of one player at Arsenal who might end up at one club in France.
Yeah.
But yeah, I suppose you're looking at... It's obviously with the wages that people are on now, it's very difficult. I mean, they're just going to hope Sterling crashes. that's the only way they're going to shift some of these guys.
Yeah, well, that is kind of what's happening if we look at the markets. So, I mean, how have you viewed what the clubs have done this summer in the market? Obviously, Manchester City have gone out early. They've spent big money. They seem to have been fairly decisive. Manchester United as well. Have spent, even though Mourinho has been complaining.
Bought big players.
They've bought gigantic players, yeah. Haven't they? It's like watching a rugby team.
Oh, crazy. Well, did you watch the Super Cup?
No.
It was an entertaining enough game, but I couldn't believe this is Manchester United now. How is there not uproar? Seriously, how is there not uproar? It's amazing, isn't it? People's capacity for... You know, they'll be loyal to anything. Yeah. Stick a Manchester United badge on it, and they'll be loyal to...
Until they stop being loyal, and then,
Yeah, then there'll be people
have no fury.
Like, who insisted all along. We didn't want a team of 6'3" guys. The ball looks really tiny next to all our players. our players' feet are so much bigger than the ball.
Like they're using a size 4.
Yeah. I think it's incredible. Throw on Fellaini,
Yeah.
This is incredible. And... I was watching the Community Shield as well, and I was thinking, oh, here we are. Arsenal look very similar to last season. Not surprising, given that, Arsene Wenger's still there. He saw off all that unrest. But he's the one who they're trying to chase out of town. And meanwhile, Fellaini, throw on Fellaini. That's the extent of Manchester United's footballing ideas.
Yeah.
If it's not going well, stick Fellaini on and he will just by blundering about, make something happen. I find it absolutely amazing that people are putting up with this nonsense.
Well, we spoke about that last year. You talked about the Mourinho style of football essentially is getting up to the big man up top, which was Zlatan, which, you know, was Drogba and what have you in the past. You know, it's not terribly sophisticated, Dion, but, you know, he's bought a big squad, spent a lot of money. There's going to be a lot of pressure on him to deliver in his, you know, famous second season in which he apparently always wins the league.
Yeah, there's huge pressure on him, and the problem is he can't do it any other way than the way he always does it. And when you watch the Super Cup, a guy who's kind of, you know, having not seen them this summer, I was kind of thinking, yeah, okay, there's a logic to this, and Matic does make sense, and he's going to release Pogba and all these guys. And then you look at the Super Cup and you're like, release Pogba to do what? Because he still looks like, it just, you know, I like, in theory, it's a great idea, and you can think that's what Pogba needs, the way kind of Steven Gerrard needed, sort of, you know, Mascherano and Alonso. This is what you get with Pogba, but it doesn't seem to happen. Like, he just does so many things badly. He's still capable of the brilliant stuff, but he does so many things badly that you think, right, that's kind of still a question mark. Lukaku, like, he is a big, but you know, even the things he's doing, like the holding up the ball and like against Madrid. He's putting so much effort into holding up the ball. It seems to be, it's all these things are kind of alien to him too. Like being the player, being that player, I don't know how good he is at that. Because when he was laying it off and stuff, I just looked at these guys. Really, he's kind of concentrating too hard on doing these things, and then he missed. You know, the chance he missed, which is, you know, it was just a classic Lukaku miss.
Yeah.
Again, the only other thing. United struggled so many times last season against weaker teams that he scores against weaker teams. So there is maybe a logic in that.
Like Lukaku's ideal game, I think, is like when he was playing for Belgium against Ireland last year. And he was just absolutely running riot.
Yeah.
I mean, against a disorganised rabble in headlong retreat, Lukaku will absolutely clean up. Like, well, He will wipe the floor with all those teams.
I thought that on RTE last night they showed the you know, they were talking about him being a flat track bully, and then they cut to clips of him, you know, running through the Irish defence. And that's like, that is the definition of a Kieran Clarke in there means you're he's a flat track bully.
You can, I mean, I think he's better. Like, I mean, as you're saying, when he's talking to Mourinho, wants the centre forward who holds up the ball and so on. He is one of those players who, despite his immense size, he looks like a hold up. But actually he's a forward who's better when he's facing towards the goal and preferably running, and that's really where he's at his best. And it's okay, he could maybe adapt to playing a different type of way, but I wouldn't expect him to be brilliant at it immediately. I do think he could easily score 25 or 30 goals though, because, well, I say that because he's done it already. I mean, he's done it playing for Everton, although Manchester United have usually had to face a different type of game from Everton, where There isn't really as much space, and teams know that when they play against a Mourinho team, a good way to get at least a draw is simply to defend, because, you know.
But I mean, Zlatan got that many goals for Manchester United last season, and they still finished sixth. So, you know, they need more. What about City, Dion? Pep Guardiola came to the Premier League, and I think in some ways discovered that he's got to be a bit more adaptable to the ideas that he has about the game, that certain things about the Premier League were a bit of a surprise to him, that he was obviously sitting in his attic room making his plans, drawing his diagrams, watching the opposition before every game, and then, you know, playing a goalkeeper for months who kept giving goals away. I mean, will he have learned a lot from that first season, and how adaptable do you think his ideas are?
I don't know how adaptable they are. I think they're still fundamentally going to be the same, but I think the players they've got and they've brought in make it easier for them to get the ideas across onto the pitch. And I thought it was going to be between City and United. I do think City are going to win the league this year. I think Jesus was a great signing. I thought they would have made it more of a challenge last year in the end if he hadn't got injured. I thought he was a really good signing, and that gives them a pretty dynamic forward line.
Sterling, Sané, Jesus, Aguero.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah, no, I think I don't know how much he will have to adapt. I think, like, the fascinating thing with Pep is just that sort of sense of him always on the point of sort of combustion. Like, you know, it's And that was the, if people wanted to think it was the Premier League, or if that's just, you know, that's the way he's been as a manager, his kind of ridiculous intensity.
I quite enjoy his disdain for the press, for the English press.
I know, it's very enjoyable.
I think that's kind of refreshing. Wasn't there a brilliant one last season where someone asked him and he went, oh, for fuck's sake.
I know, but sometimes I'm looking at that. I mean, I agree. I mean, it is good to see that sometimes, because the questions they're asked are so stupid often. But there are other times when I look at Pep and I'm like, what right do you have to treat this person like that? And if this is the way that you behave in front of an audience of literally 3,000 people on Sky Sports 1, you know,
that what, many.
Well, the ratings have been falling. There are many more people watching illegally on NBC or whatever. But if this is the way you behave in public, imagine what goes on at that club. Imagine what goes on
the training ground.
Every time someone sort of, you know, questions Pep or seems to stupidly not get what he's saying first time around, well, the kind of things that happen, the little slights, does he even know how disrespectful he is at times? Does he care about that? And I think it's something you do need to care about, because players all get pissed off and start bitching to each other. And suddenly you've got like, I mean, it hasn't happened to him at his previous clubs. You did have players at Bayern talking about how they were looking forward to Carlo Ancelotti coming in, you know, and people would start having fun again. You know, Zlatan was really the only one who broke ranks at Barcelona and was like, this is a joke, you know. But, you know, at Man City, like I was reading, say, the other day, Robbie Fowler's autobiography, which is a bit of a random one. I mean, it's from 2005, I think. He's talking, say, for instance, about Kevin Keegan, who he worked with as England manager. Now, what would you say Kevin Keegan's great strength as a manager was?
Man management.
Right, you know, motivation. Like, come on, lads. Getting all the lads together and, you know, maybe everyone is having a big gambling school down the back of the bus. Everyone's down the back of the bus losing enormous amounts of money. And everyone is feeling great. Well, he said when Kevin Keegan was England manager, it was just his attempts at man management were just a total disaster. Like, it was like having your maiden aunt, you know, hanging around the pool room going, yeah, all right, lads. Like, sort of trying to chat to them. And they're just like, yeah, and he writes them like literally you're kind of awkwardly sort of smiling while edging towards the door, you know, trying to get. So the point about that is what worked well for Keegan in one context at Newcastle didn't work when he was the England manager. You know, time had moved on, he'd got a bit older, he'd maybe changed a little bit, people's ideas about him had changed.
Well, the thing they always kind of is saying, whatever style of management it is, unless you kind of have credibility or you have the players buy into it, it doesn't work. And I think Keegan is a perfect example, because at Newcastle, he had this wave of adulation from the fans, this sense of kind of momentum that they were just building and building and building. And then when he went to England, it was an attempt to sort of recreate something that you couldn't recreate in a different context. And again, yeah, that idea. But, you know, and the thing with Keegan was he was like, a bit like Pep, he was actually extremely kind of, he was quite brittle underneath, you know. So he wasn't a man manager who wasn't like, if I can imagine, you know, if his attempts at sort of enthusiasm backfired, he'd be kind of walking away deeply wounded at this idea.
Yeah, that, you know, with everyone hearing the titters from behind him. But I just don't know if Pep can.
Do you not think he has that credibility?
Oh, he's got credibility.
I think he does.
He's got credibility. But I don't know if he has necessarily the same connection with these players as he did at Barcelona.
Because, I mean, at Barcelona, everything came together to make it seem like this is the cult you believe in.
Yeah,
like Pep, you know, he's got the history, he's everything. It's just the perfect combination.
Sure.
And such nice players. I mean, it's a story about Iniesta that Pep is like struggling because he's like, did he lose his first two games or lose his first and draw his second? He didn't start great at Barcelona, and he's there, you know, scratching his head in his office, obviously thinking that the world is collapsing and everything is a disaster, when little Andres Iniesta pops his head around the door and says, don't worry, mister, you know, we believe in you and we will fight with you until the end. And like Pep is there, Iniesta like smiles at him and walks away, and Pep is like in floods of tears, oh Iniesta, you're so amazing. And you think, well, okay, that shows what a nice man Andres Iniesta is. And also a good judge of a coach, you know. But most players are not like that.
But also nice players, but also great players. So if you come in as a figurehead, and you've got Xavi and Iniesta and Messi,
yeah,
it's easier to be the figurehead, especially when you've got Xavi and Iniesta who come through, and Messi who come through that school as well.
It's no use Otamendi sticking his head around the door and saying, don't worry, that's the whole problem.
Navas saying, you know, we're with you, mister.
So, I mean, would they be your favourites, nevertheless?
Oh, City definitely, because just their players are so good. I mean, their players are so good. We talked about their forward line. They've got Silva, you know, still pretty good when he's fit. Bernardo Silva, who's brilliant. Kevin De Bruyne, who's brilliant. They still don't really have anyone in... I mean, who do they have in midfield? They signed somebody... Oh, God. Who is their bloody... They signed like a defensive midfielder. But the main thing they've obviously gone for is fullbacks, because this is the thing Pep had been complaining about.
No Sanya, no Clichy, no Kolarov.
I think he looks at it and he thinks there's a general deficiency of English football. There are no fullbacks here. And it was something also, I mean, I remember there was a Duncan Castles piece with a guy, the sporting director from Monaco.
Duncan Castles did a piece that wasn't about Mourinho?
Yeah, well, look, it was the sporting director of Monaco. I mean, who's the agent that brings most of the players in and out of Monaco? I mean, there are always these sorts of connections. But, you know, if someone is connected to a particular part of the football world, this guy's, you know, Portuguese, I think, so he had some. But one of the things he said, one of the interesting things in this piece was he was saying, look, I look at England and I don't see any good fullbacks. The entire league, I look through the league. Which team in that league has good fullbacks? Tottenham, that's it. And obviously, Manchester City have since bought one of those Tottenham fullbacks. And he kind of saying it's a general defending in general is a problem in the Premier League. If you look at I was saying this today on our podcast, but if you look at the Premier League fantasy football, the top defender in it is David Luiz. Now, I'm a fan of David Luiz. I wouldn't pick him in fantasy football necessarily, and he was by far the most popular defender as team selected by. But if you look down the list, there are no good defenders. You're looking at it, you're going, this is a fairly mediocre bunch, you know, and it is a general problem. I mean, this probably is why. I mean, compared to like 10 years ago, you had 10 or 11 years ago, you know, you had like Vidic, Ferdinand, John Terry,
Carvalho,
Sammy Hippia, Jamie Carragher, Ricardo Carvalho. You had Saul Campbell. You know, you had really, really top defenders in most of the big teams, and that's no longer the case. You know, that's really not happening. I mean, David Luiz is the best defender in the Premier League. He is, and that's not good.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could, much as it pains me to say it, you could probably make a case for the two Tottenham defenders, who were very important.
Vertonghen and Alvarez. Yeah,
yeah, good. You know,
they remind me a bit of Carvalho, actually.
But I think the case about Tottenham is, and this is the other rare thing in the Premier League compared to 10 years ago, is that sense of a team being shaped by a really strong-willed coach who's got a vision for them and has a very set way he wants them to play. And, you know, when you talk about those teams, that was when Mourinho, first time at Chelsea, Benitez at Liverpool, and they could, you know, they were successful in Europe. They had a way of playing that wasn't that attractive, but they didn't concede many goals. Pochettino saw it slightly different, but at the same time, he has a vision that he's kind of he's getting his team to sort of display, and that isn't happening. Like, Klopp had it a bit at Liverpool last season. But again, defensively, they're not very good. Mourinho's style is Mourinho's style, but it's getting more and more reductive. Arsenal, you know, again, I'm not sure what Arsenal's style. I'm not sure what Arsenal's style is anymore. Like, it's
that's difficult to know.
Yeah, it's like the days of when people still, there's sort of a legacy issue with Arsenal, where people say, "Oh, I love watching them," but you know, they're not effective. And
certainly for the last couple of seasons, the football has not been what you would call traditionally Arsene Wenger football. But we might come on to that. But just staying with Tottenham and Liverpool for a second, because we're talking about the top six. I mean, should it be a top seven maybe with Everton, given the money that they've spent? No, I'm not sure. But I just want to ask, do you think part of Pochettino's vision is to not buy any players this summer? Or is that Daniel Levy's vision?
I mean, that's always Daniel Levy's vision.
They're obviously building a new stadium. We saw the impact that it had on Arsenal, who had a very... You know, as much as people want to say it had a massive impact, Arsenal knew every season what they had to pay. It was a relatively manageable amount. Tottenham Stadium is costing twice as much as Arsenal's.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Levy should be paying more attention to that than this is the project that needs serious management. Mm. It's crazy what's going on. But, you know, again, like, follow the Ross Barkley thing. Ross Barkley, supposedly, Tottenham would like to sign him from Everton. A couple of weeks ago, the story was, well, Ross Barkley will cost 50 million. And then 2 weeks later, it's like, Everton drop asking price to 35 million. Tottenham thinks still too high. And I'm like, how are Tottenham the only club where this happens? You know, they sit there and wait and the price comes down. This is crazy. They reverse the laws of physics that apply to everybody else, apparently. So I think that's what Levy obviously intends to do, is wait on the last minute, get the players, which is a little bit risky, but maybe he thinks there's so much money at stake.
That's his only option.
Yeah,
I mean, he also has a reputation to uphold now as well.
Yeah,
he can't go out. You know, this is
he makes the best deals.
Yeah, he makes the best deals.
Well, certainly, when it comes to selling, he's got a good reputation for that, doesn't he? In terms of
but they also always work the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, like Sissoko was a terrible signing, but again, mm-hmm. it's always done. There's always a style to it, which mm-hmm. is the kind of Daniel Levy way. So mm-hmm. I think he'll do the same again, and yeah, but it is extraordinary. Maybe it's just the reputation he brings makes people think, well, we're not going to get the 50 million, so we might as well cut to the chase now, even though the chase will actually end on 31st of August or whenever.
But I mean, I remember sitting here talking to you a year ago about Tottenham, saying, Tottenham, after what happened to them last season, will they be able to do that again? I mean, they put so much effort into it and ended up so broken that surely this is going to sort of have a knock-on effect into the season. And, okay, they didn't start actually that well. They kind of drew a few games. They weren't scoring a lot of goals. And then suddenly they were away, and they were the best team in the league. I thought they were clearly better than Chelsea for two-thirds of the season. But it didn't matter because Chelsea had sort of won it by Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have been the best team over the last two seasons, you know, on points. There are any prizes for this and so on. I think what I underestimated about them was just how good Harry Kane and Dele Alli really are. I mean, they're ridiculous. Again, they have to sort of keep doing this, but they're clearly good enough to do that. Mm. I mean, it's and I think Pochettino is able to keep it together. I do think if they don't sign anyone, they're going to have a problem if they start badly again, because you know everyone suddenly starts losing faith. It's like, oh, what's going on here? You know, the stadium is going to ruin us like it did all the other clubs who have built the stadium ever, and you know, we're just going to lose our players. Everybody's going to leave.
They have issues with depth as well, don't they? Because they've got to play Champions League football again. Obviously, they were in Champions League last season, but they're playing at Wembley.
Mm.
They've got. They don't have the depth.
Are they going to have 90,000 people at every game? By the way,
is that what's
going to happen? Like,
no, I don't think so.
Are they going to be playing in a half-empty stadium, or are they just going to give out tickets free?
Well, they're selling a lot of tickets at very cheap prices, I believe.
Well, that could be amazing. I mean, it could be imagine they have like a 90,000 crowd.
But Tottenham aren't going to get 90,000 people.
Why not? Would you not go and see Tottenham? Well, I mean, no, maybe it wouldn't be that rabidly partisan a 90,000 crowd.
That's the wrong one.
But you know, if you could go and see a Premier League match for like a tenner, you know?
Yeah, maybe.
Lots of people would go. Yeah. Even if they did have to go to Wembley.
Yeah.
You know, I think it would. I mean, I don't know what their price structure is or how it's going to work out. I mean, it would obviously be
you can't just start selling them at, like, if you start selling for a tenner,
then you've just got loads of people in the cheap seats and no one in the expensive seats.
Yeah, everyone's just going to wait for the £10 tickets to come available. I don't know how that's going to work.
Yeah.
So maybe they'll just decide to have 50,000, 60,000.
They leave the top deck.
Yeah, do some donutting. Get away, like, politicians, they sort of swarm around, like the person making a speech to make it look like everyone's there. Yeah. They'll just do some donutting in the crowd and everyone will just be moving around.
That's the issue of camera angles. That's something Rory Smith says is a problem with Italian football. He says, well, actually, Italian football isn't as dead as it always appears to be on TV. If you go to a game, you'll see there's a massive crowd there. They're just all in the upper tier of a two-tier bowl stadium, and the camera never picks up their presence. You can hear them in the background, but all you see is this empty concrete lower tier, and you think there's no one at this game, and actually there's 40,000 people there, and this is a problem of camera angles that they really should address.
Well, I think that's going to be a challenge for them. Wembley is not somewhere they particularly enjoy playing. They might do, but you know, it's not home, so whether that has any tangible impact, we'll see.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
What about Liverpool, Dion? They've, like some of the other clubs, are having problems signing the players that they want. I was listening, Ken, to your chat with the guys from the Anfield Wrap, was really interesting podcast, just to get their views on things and the idea of maybe selling Coutinho, which doesn't look like it's going to happen because Barcelona are going to go for Dembele, it seems, from Dortmund. So Liverpool won't have another £120 million that they can't spend, Dion.
Yeah, well, I think that was the big problem with Coutinho if they were to sell him as well. It's just... who are they going to buy? I do think there's probably, like, Coutinho, like, looking at him, he's not Suarez. You know, if you lose him, he's not Suarez. It's not as big a blow, I don't think, to the team as losing Suarez. On the other hand, he's also not Jordan Henderson, you know, so you kind of need, like, he's pretty important in that regard. But the bigger problem is, I think he's replaceable, but the problem is they can't seem to get anybody that they want. So there's no point in selling him on that basis. I think I kind of liked what they were doing in the summer, that they were set, like, and Klopp is sort of holding to it again, you know, we don't need to buy any defenders, he's got his targets, and if he doesn't get them, he's not going to get anyone else. But that is kind of predicated on that you don't lose any of your big players too. So I think they still need a defender. Again, I think they need a defender, but I also need to be able to defend. Like, if Van Dijk goes to Liverpool, I still see him as just the latest in a long line of players wandering away, looking kind of puzzled as they've conceded from a corner.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing, and it's and until they address that, which Klopp doesn't seem to be able to address either, they're still going to have the same problems.
The Van Dijk thing was interesting, wasn't it? Whatever they did there, or however they approached that.
Well, it's because they've had so many kind of dodgy dealings. You know, they had this whole issue with the kid they signed from Stoke.
They've got
a transfer ban for young players already. A history of malfeasance. the Clint Dempsey thing, didn't they announce they'd signed Clint Dempsey on the website?
Yeah.
You know.
But this is also came out this briefing, I don't know if it was a briefing, but this emergence of stories simultaneously that Van Dijk wanted to join Liverpool and, you know, so much look forward to working under Jurgen Klopp. And that desperate urge of Liverpool supporters online for, you know, like the messages, everyone, that, you know, John Henry got it for years. Like, anytime he post anything, it was just sign Marcus, sign Royce. Just sign Royce.
I don't know.
And it's like they have to, at some stage, like, they kind of say, we must resist, we mustn't respond to this, but, like, give them something.
Yeah.
And so they just put something out there before they really should.
Yeah.
and it backfires.
Disaster.
And again, you're seeing it with like the new chief executive seems to be getting very irritated
with people abusing him
and like putting up sort of screenshots of, you know, how some certain abusive tweets only got one like and this kind of stuff. Like, and it's
did he do that? He put up a screenshot
of some abusive tweet saying at least it only got one like.
Oh, right,
but then it's going to get loads more likes. Yeah.
I think it might have been deleted at that stage.
Trying to send a message, and
he said, you know, and saying to them, I kind of even don't think that's what he should be, you know, the idea of saying it's not my responsibility.
No, it's just like, oh, not me. Like, abuse that guy over there. It's Michael Edwards you need to be getting on to. He's the guy who's failed to bring in any of these players. Please direct your abuse.
That doesn't really speak to a cohesive strategy or it's just not common sense, is it? Because it's not, let's be realistic, it is not unique to Liverpool Twitter. That football Twitter in general is quite bonkers, and you know, I know it from Arsenal. Arsenal Twitter is a bit nuts as well.
Yeah.
But it's just as a football club, you've got to take one view of it, right? You can say, well, look, this shit exists, but we should probably not engage with it.
Yeah.
As a football club, we should not really engage with it.
I just feel as though, you know, I don't have any confidence in the institutional side of Liverpool, the kind of companies, the front office, is that or the back office?
Front or back, yeah.
I don't know. The team headed by Jurgen Klopp seems to me to know what it's doing. I think he's doing a good job with the team. You know, I think they're generally playing well. They play a good style of football. I think he's good. He projects a good sort of image. He's got a good way of putting things, you know. He makes people feel, yeah, you know, this is all. And it seems to me on that side to be a better run club than it has been for at any previous time in the Premier League. But I don't really see that being. I don't really see the competence there on the other side. I don't see any evidence. I mean, you know, this apologising for tapping up a Southampton player, like what? What is happening there? Like the inability to sign players, the fact of this whole scouting team that's there with, you know, physicists and all this kind of stuff, and like they conclude, yeah, physicists. You hire physicists because they've got advanced quantitative problem solving skills.
Come on.
So you apply their giant. Do you know Dominic Cummings, the Brexit Leave guy? He's all into this kind of stuff. Hire physicists, you know, sack Jon Snow from Channel 4 News, sack Robert Peston, and hire physicists.
Dan Hodges.
Yeah, these guys just talk nonsense. Get physicists on there because they have got this. They can think in. They can think about numbers. They understand mathematics. They understand statistics, and they can solve problems. This is how problems are solved these days. Not by writing 800 words. You know, that's just a lot of nonsense. Anyway, they hire these guys, and what do they come up with? Oh, sign Van Dijk. You're like, well, you know, anyone could tell you that Van Dijk would be a good player. Like, sign Naby Keita. Oh, he'll cost 70 million. Oh, right, okay. You know, it's like, well, do you not have a second player? Is the whole point of this not that you should be able to...
You've got a list of targets, and if you don't get your first one, you move down the list.
You should be. And there's no point if you just come back and say, well, let's sign the best defender in the league. Well, who doesn't already play for, you know, Chelsea?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like... I don't really see what value they're getting out of that. I mean, it is amazing when you look at it, how that Liverpool have never won the Premier League. It's incredible. It is actually incredible. And I know people have got used to thinking them as a kind of all-around club. But actually, when you look back at it, like, no, there's no club that has had this many near misses that has been continually strong over the entire period. You know, strong enough to be, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth.
Without winning it at some point.
Without ever winning it. Mm. And it's just because of this, they've constantly been incompetently managed. Like, that has actually changed on the football side. But I think that, you know, on the other side, it's not really there. And then they've got this other issue, the reputational issue now of, well, people don't think they're a big club anymore. You know, at least in the 90s, it was like, oh, Liverpool want me. You know, that was a big deal. Like, Alan Shearer probably would have joined them if they'd, you know, actually paid the money this kind of thing. Whereas they wouldn't get a player of that status now. Mm. And they lose all their best players join Barcelona and Real Madrid. And it's not just... like Coutinho, Suarez, you know, Mascherano, Alonso players, the Latin players. It's McManaman and Owen, like players from the same part of England also go to Spain, because, I mean, in both of those cases, because Liverpool had screwed up on their end of the see, this is why I was reading Robbie Fowler's book the other day. He's very, very harsh on how they screwed up the Steve McManaman deal, you know.
Well, that was his best mate.
Yeah. Not as greedy or crafty as a lot of people thought he was after that move. Actually, Liverpool had shook hands on the deal, then came back to him with a lower deal. He said, well, you can't expect me to do that.
Yeah.
And they said, well, we do, actually. He said, well, actually, I'm going to join Real Madrid in a free transfer.
Well, they nearly lost Gerrard to Chelsea in a similar way.
But it seems like it's a thing that football clubs do, because when Arsenal signed Mikel Arteta from Everton in that crazy, like, end of August, that, like, after the 8-2, they'd agreed a deal with Everton. And then, as he was on his way to London, they made a lower offer. And, like, after his first season, he said, oh, fuck it, I'm going to do it anyway. And after his first season, there was a delegation of players went to the club to say, look, you've fucking lowballed this guy.
Yeah.
You can't do that. Give him a new deal, which they did.
He nearly crashed his car off the road when he heard that.
Another one.
Swerved
in. Another one. Well, look, let's talk a little bit about Arsenal. Dion, they've a very big squad. They've added a couple of players in... Kolasinac and Alexandre Lacazette. And the overriding issue, though, has been that of Alexis Sanchez. I know people are really cynical. This morning, there was a press conference. Arsene Wenger said he's out for a couple of weeks, and everyone's going, oh, well, look, that's it. They're going to sell him. This is all part of the process of selling him. Whereas the message from Wenger throughout this summer has been really, really consistent. I know he said it in the past about players like Van Persie and Fabregas and Nasri, but he's been absolutely strident this summer about his desire to keep Alexis Sanchez. Do you think that's the right decision for Arsenal to make?
Yeah, because I don't know what they'll do without him. I thought some of the way he behaved last season was ridiculous. And if they had better players, you would think, right, this is a player you need to kind of get out of here, because he's making such a show of being upset and being the only player who really cares and all that kind of stuff. That was kind of tiresome. But Arsenal's problem again is who they, like, there is such a randomness to how they approach transfers and who they get, and their inability to really get players who will make that key difference. I don't know what you do if you lose Sanchez. I also think the thing, like, Wenger is an amazing way, and he does this with a lot of things, of insisting that what is happening in this particular case is indicative of a broader trend. So, yeah, and also I'm trying to insist that this is the kind of best way of looking at it. So when he says Sanchez will see out his contract, you're going to see a lot more of this happening. It's kind of like he's willing it to, you know, this is what's going to happen.
Whether that's true or not.
Yeah. But it's like, I've detected a global trend here, and it tends to be more of an Arsenal trend rather than a global trend a lot of the time. You know, like when he says about society, like, you know, he may be right or he may be wrong, but he's kind of talking about Arsenal fans rather than society as a whole. Although maybe they mirror society. But it's not really...
Pretty good cross-section of London society.
Oh, no, cross-section. Yeah, it is. But it doesn't mean... It doesn't. I don't know how much of the broader society he's talking about, rather than just people saying, you know, sitting in the stand holding up signs with wish lists of players and stuff like that that
sure.
you can see at the Emirates.
What do you think of the Sanchez situation? I mean, to me, it makes sense for Arsenal to keep him for another season, simply because if you get £60 million for him, what do you buy for £60 million that is going to replace what Alexis Sanchez can do for you? Maybe you buy someone like Thomas Lemar, who in two seasons could flourish into that kind of a player with that level of productivity. But if Arsenal really want to challenge for the Premier League title, then they've got no option but to keep Sanchez and maybe look at, if they're going to take a financial hit on him, try and offset that by selling somebody else who's not quite as important.
They should absolutely keep him, because you look at the fact that they've already taken a financial hit. They're not in the Champions League. They need to get back into it. Or if they don't get back into it, they will take another financial hit. You know, if they lose Sanchez for nothing, they take a financial hit. But, you know, if they have Sanchez, they've got a better chance of not taking the first financial hit of failing to get into the Champions League. So, and then being in the Champions League is good for your status, you know, in terms of getting somebody to replace Sanchez when he leaves on a free transfer, which he may or may not do.
Yeah.
Because the other thing that you say to Sanchez is, we're not going to sell you. Here's a new contract with a pay rise. Up to you.
Well, that, to me, that makes a lot of sense. That, you know, if there's an acceptance that he wants to leave, but and part of the reason, let's face it, part of the reason that he will want to leave is because he's 28 years of age. He's at the point in his career where his earning potential is at a maximum. Mm. You know, going back to what we said about Neymar and players wanting money, that a situation relatively similar to what happened with Suarez. He got a big pay rise at Liverpool with the understanding that if the right bid came in from the right club that they would let him go. Mm. So Sanchez, if he's earning 140, 120, 130 grand a week at Arsenal now, could have a season of earning twice that and then move.
Leave so from on a buyout clause.
Yeah, whatever, yeah. So from both sides, it makes a bit of sense.
I can see that possibly being worked out. But even if Sanchez was to say, no, I won't sign any of your damn contracts, then they say, well, okay, you can stay here until the one you have runs out, but we're not going to sell you because we at Arsenal have been hoarding cash for so many years that we could take 10 of these financial hits and not even blink. That's how much money we have been hoarding.
Mm.
And you know, that money has ultimately got to be used for some purpose other than just enriching, you know, the people who own Arsenal. I mean, surely at some point they've got to spend it on football. I mean, they're doing that. I know Arsenal are a big budget club. They do spend plenty of money on their team. But, you know, they could spend, as we know, they could spend a bit more. They're a club who could afford to tell Sanchez, no, we actually need you more than
the money,
which we, what are we going to do with the money? Like as you said, buy Lamar, who isn't as good as you. Maybe he will be, but, yeah. Like, he probably won't be this season anyway. No. I mean, like you mentioned Lacazette as well. Like, I'm not too sure about Lacazette. I mean, he obviously looks...
Your face is look. You look so disappointed already.
No. I mean, I understand the concerns because he scored a lot of goals in France, but I think you've got to take into account the level of the league and the level of the opposition. And look, he's a player that's been on Wenger's radar for a long time, but he's never quite been convinced enough to go for it.
Yeah.
This season, maybe, I don't know. He's 26. He's at exactly the right age, perhaps, but.
I just think it's expecting a lot for him to be really good in his first season because it will take a while for him to get used to a much faster game. Maybe he'll thrive. Maybe this is what he's been looking for all along.
Mm.
But, you know, I think...
But the problem with Arsenal is that they've never addressed and the actual fundamental kind of structural flaws in the side, no matter how much money they spend, have never kind of attacked the fundamental kind of failings of the team. So you get Ozil, you spend a lot of money on Ozil, but Ozil is just a kind of enhanced version. Sanchez, to a degree, addresses some things, but you know, you have these summers where you kind of think it's clear what Arsenal need to do now, and it doesn't get done. The kind of getting a team that has a different heart, that doesn't still have Theo Walcott in it as often, you know, these things.
Well, I mean, I think that's true of the team as it stands. I mean, the move to the back three has pretty much negated Theo Walcott's position in the team because if he's not a striker, he's not really one of the two behind the strikers.
It's taken so long.
Sure.
To kind of deal with this, which is kind of such a failing, and it's not it's sort of Walcott as emblematic of something as well, you know, and it's. You don't want to get all kind of Roy Keane on it, but like it's sort of that kind of, you know, Kieran Gibbs captain thing that is never really addressed. Like Suarez, bang the same drum about Arsenal, but like this not signing Suarez was the big, one of the big turning points in their kind of recent history, I think. Because when you sign Suarez, more than any other player, more than Sanchez, you were saying, right, we're actually now going to be a different team. We're not going to be... We're not going to be the kind of nice guys.
Yeah.
You know, putting aside, you know, all his, like, my favorite thing Suarez did at Liverpool, apart from, you know, as a kind of presence on the pitch, was that time when they were playing United at Old Trafford, and Ryan Giggs was about to head a ball, and suddenly he let it drop behind him, and Suarez nicked in and ran off with it. And Giggs started shouting at the referee, and Suarez had shouted, "My ball."
You don't even get away with that in Sunday league.
Yeah, because you don't have it. It's one of those things in professional sport, nobody does it. It might happen in Sunday league, and then at a certain level, it's so disrespectful that nobody does it. Mm. And Suarez at Old Trafford did it. And Giggs was just like looking at the ref, going, what, are you going to do something about this? And Suarez was kind of heading towards goal. And I thought, that's, you know, like, that's everything you want. That's everything kind of Arsenal, every club needs, really. Yeah. But, like, he would have fundamentally, like a virus, he would have attacked all the things that are kind of, all the failings in the kind of...
Well, either that or Theo Walcott would have ended up looking a bit like Voldemort as Suarez bit his nose off. I mean, like, you know, I don't know if you put him in there, I think he might have gone crazy.
Yeah, possibly.
I mean, the problem with Arsenal, like, I mean, switch to three at the back. After what, 20 years? Mm-hmm. What? Suddenly this is a good idea. This is nonsense. Well, yeah, it's difficult. It's just difficult to take Wenger seriously when he does that. It's like, it just looks as though this, you know, this sort of eminence grise of the game, who has religiously had a flat back for, you know, for his entire career at Arsenal, pretty much. I mean, it was basically the first thing he did when he arrived, isn't he? Yeah. Oh, we're not playing back three anymore. Yeah. That's a lot of nonsense, yeah. You know. Suddenly it's like looking over at Antonio Conte doing it, and it's like, oh, that seems to work.
Well, I mean, I think he was in a position where he and the team had hit a wall. So
but he's also desperate, isn't he? But, like, you look at what he said in the past about sporting directors, various things that he's now kind of more open to. Mm. You know, there was a time when he said, you know, today a sporting director arrives at the club, it's a day I leave, or something like that. You know, there was some, like...
I mean, I think, he's obviously a proud man. I think he was... The idea that somebody might come in as a footballing director and have authority over the team, but, you know, you can't tell a 67-year-old man who's been in the game for 30 years that some guy is going to come in, you know, in a suit, maybe a physicist, is going to come in and start signing the players for him. So I get that to a certain extent.
I get it at all, but I think it's just the kind of sadness of the Wenger story, like that everything, even going, like something that is just tactical, like switching to, you know, three at the back, is actually kind of a signpost in the sad decline and the sort of this story that won't kind of end and refuses, and like you keep thinking, when is this? I think the strangest thing about this summer is that there isn't even it's sort of just becalmed.
Well, I mean, winning the FA Cup went a long way to calming people down.
You should accept that winning the FA Cup is worth something. I mean, Manchester United didn't when they sacked Louis van Gaal immediately after he won it, like seconds after.
But they've won the FA Cup. It didn't stand for much the last couple of seasons when people were enraged, you know, by November or December when the Arsenal won the Cup.
Yeah, I mean, it stops you getting sacked after the game. Or it should.
I think in some ways beating Chelsea was as significant as winning the cup.
Yeah, and City as well. I mean, they beat City in the semi.
Yeah, but beating Chelsea to win the cup by beating Chelsea.
Yeah, well, stopping them doing the double, and obviously it was a fantastic performance on the day from a fairly, I won't say the entire team was makeshift, but certainly the back three was makeshift.
What are they going to do with Oxlade-Chamberlain?
This is a big question for me because I really think that he could go. I spoke about him at his press conference, said he's a fantastic player, he's on the way up, but Oxlade-Chamberlain wants to play central midfield. That's where he wants to play, and what we've seen over the course of pre-season, he didn't even play him there in pre-season. He's playing like Ainsley Maitland-Niles and Joe Willock, young players. He's giving them games in central midfield. He's not playing Oxlade-Chamberlain in central midfield. He plays him as a left wing back in the Community Shield. I don't think he was particularly good on the day. But he's obviously not ahead of Bellerin in the pecking order. Now we've got the new guy, the Bosnian guy, who came on and looked absolutely great. He played as part of the back three, but that's where they've bought him for that left-sided role. And it's hard to know where Oxlade-Chamberlain plays. When you've got 12 months left on your contract like he has, what do Arsenal do in that situation? If they're not going to play him where he wants to play...
And
you think he's going to be a great player?
No, I'd sell
him. It's hard to tally up those two things, isn't it? That belief that he's going to be a great player if you're not prepared to play him where
he wants to play. I mean, what kind of great player does he think he is?
I don't know. And he's always said he's going to be a central midfield player, but like never uses him there unless it's an emergency.
Yeah, I always thought he was going to be a central midfielder. When he emerged first, he did look like he was going to do it there. But yeah, I don't know what they'll, but then who are you going to sell him to, and how does that impact you if
he goes on to thrive somewhere else?
Yeah. Sometimes that happens.
Well, it is, but I mean, if you're not
going to use it, see, it's a different case from Sanchez, because Sanchez is obviously a key player in the Arsenal team, and he plays all the time whenever he's fit and is brilliant. Whereas Chamberlain could easily be on the bench and no one would pay any attention, no one would notice. So he's not really a core player there. He hasn't sort of managed to define what he is, or obviously his definition of himself is in conflict with Wenger's. So you know, he should be forcing his way out of there. You know, he's saying, "Look, come on, this is nonsense. Why are you keeping me? You don't even want me. You know, I've got X offer, Y offer. I mean, I don't know if he has any offers. There was stories linking him with, you know, Liverpool and Chelsea, which obviously are you know, the strongest teams, some of the strongest teams in the league. It shows that he's obviously a highly rated player. But if there's no point, especially at this stage in his career, sitting at Arsenal and not really. No.
Well, he's not signing a new deal. He's been offered a new deal and he's not signing it. And he says it's not about money, it's about where he's going to play. And that, to me, is the big issue. Because if he's not going to play him, he doesn't see him ahead of Bellerin and he sees him as backup left wing back, where the hell, you know, what is the future for him? We'll see. But just before we finish up, Dion, Arsenal have a different European adventure ahead of them this season. The Europa League is obviously not where they wanted to be, but it's where they are. And given the record in the Champions League, like 7 successive seasons going out in the round of 16 in various different convoluted ways, sometimes to great teams, other times to not so great teams, you know, winning the group last season and then ending up playing Bayern Munich anyway, there's a repetitiveness to that, certainly from an Arsenal fan's point of view. The Europa League is something different, and if we're being realistic about Arsenal's European calibre, a reasonable trophy that they could go for.
Yeah, but again, the problem, I'd like Arsenal without any European football might be the kind of, that might be the best thing for them this season, if they're in that position that Chelsea and Liverpool were in.
I don't agree with that, actually, because of what Gary Cahill was pointing out about the match programme. Look how many players Arsenal have. I mean, they literally have an entire squad more players than Chelsea. 17. They had 17 more players. Now, I know not all of these players are senior, you know, top first 11 type players, but they have such a massive squad. You were already talking about the difficulty of moving out some of these guys. One thing the Europa League does is give game opportunities to people, you know, and you can do that. It's the only sensible way to do it, really, to play the... Because it is, it's physically difficult, you know, especially after you know, in the new year, to it starts kind of early and there's so many games. But if the kind of group stage can be handled by your squad players, I mean, you should try and do that. And then once it's in the knockout stage, well, then that's a more interesting kind of football to be playing anyway. You know, that's, it would be good for them to get a bit of practice playing knockout football, because every time they're in a knockout tie, they lose immediately in European football. That's what's been happening.
Yeah, I think
for a decade.
In theory, you can do that with the squad, but I think you really need to say, right, we're going to leave like 10 players behind.
Absolutely, do that.
You know, don't bring them. Don't have any involvement. And then, but then if you go out, maybe you go out. But I think. I would be interested to see Arsenal do well in a knockout tournament. I think there's something about Arsenal in knockout European football that, whatever the situation, that there's something in the personality of the side that means they like Monaco being the great example. That they stumble. But I think you need to be really firm on that, because otherwise it's a drain. Like in the Thursday Sunday thing, I think it's a real drain. I think it has a. There's something about for some reason it feels a lot closer together than like Wednesday, Saturday Champions League.
It does, even
games.
In my head when you say it, I was thinking it's the same as Wednesday to Saturday, but Thursday,
I just can't
Sunday
understand is, why it's different.
I think it's something to do with building up. This is, you know, this is no basis in any scientific fact.
Yeah,
no physicist would endorse this message. But I kind of think you're into thinking about the weekend's game immediately.
Yeah.
Because you play on a Thursday night somewhere, you get back in the middle of the night, and it's Friday, and then it's all, once you get to Friday in English football, all you're thinking about is the weekend.
Yeah.
So your preparation, you're kind of into the build up, even if it's a Sunday game, it's into the kind of prep for the game. So it has a lag that doesn't happen when you've Wednesday And a Thursday is a kind of a clear day where you're not really, there's a sort of a no man's land between the Wednesday and the weekend. This is my own, this is my only way I can explain why it feels so different.
And it, and it is, I suppose, it kind of is a reinforcement of your secondary status as well every week. Like,
well, there is that. But I do think you're just immediately, it's right, what do you do? Right, it's, Friday is a build-up to the weekend. Friday is when teams have their press conferences. Most of the time they start talking about the weekend. They start focusing on the weekend's games, whether they're Saturday or Sunday. So the minute you play, you're now thinking of the weekend.
Yeah.
Whereas when you play on a Wednesday, there's just that little, there's that little gap that means you can, I think maybe you recharge in that time psychologically. Like, clearly, physically, it doesn't have any, shouldn't make any difference. But there is just that thing of, and then it just seems, you know, there's something about this, and there's the drudgery of it. I think also taps into that idea that this is your lot now. You're in Europa League.
You
failed in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I still think they can't really afford to, I mean, the fact is, an English team has got to the final of this the last two seasons. And Manchester United are in the Champions League thanks to it. I mean, imagine they hadn't. Imagine Jose Mourinho said, I'm not interested in that. If he'd been consistent, but if he had stuck with his everything he'd previously said about the
Europa League. But this is the bind, isn't it? Yeah, but you then have to... So do you then say, well, you know, this will be quite a good way. If we're struggling, if we're fifth or sixth in February or March, this will be quite a handy competition to be in. Do you then hold to your line if you've got a tricky game in October, you say, right, we're leaving everyone behind? You know, that's the thing. So, like, do you?
So, you mean if you got a tricky game in the Premier League and you rest all your players in the Europa League?
No. If you don't, if you hold to the line we said you should hold to, if you're Arsenal, and not bring the first team to Europe. But if you've got a tricky game, and you think actually, I would like to be in the Europa. I think I don't want to get knocked out of the Europa League. Can I leave everyone behind? Can I leave my first team behind?
Yeah.
So that's when it gets tricky, because it is a good competition to have in. You know, for those reasons, like, it's a great way of getting into the Champions League. And if Arsenal want to get back in the Champions League,
it may be their best chance.
But it's an awful lot of effort. By going for it, you're almost saying this is our best chance, because you take something away from the league.
Do you see Arsenal as top four, realistic top four contenders?
Maybe. I mean, see, no one really knows what's going to happen yet. I think City are the best team. I think, you know, the other teams are a little bit, you know, well, I mean, I'm a bit confused by what's happening with Chelsea. I don't really understand why they're so blasé about losing important players like Costa and Matic without really... I mean, they have got Morata and Bakayoko, but, you know...
What if Mourinho was right? What if it turns out that Chelsea are... the last season implosion at Chelsea, Mourinho was actually down to the hierarchy of the club? That would be...
Well, it'll be disappointing.
Disappointing for all of us. We've insisted that they reveal deep character flaws. But I was looking at, you know, when you look at Chelsea at the moment, you're going, how come this is happening again? Like, there are certain things going on, and, you know, Conte has kind of frustrations that look familiar.
Yeah, and the fact of Hazard isn't fit. I mean, he's not going to be fit, I guess, for a while. I mean, even if he's back in training and so on, it takes ages for him to get up to his kind of match winning speed.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a huge problem, because, I mean, Hazard and Costa were half their team last year, and one of them is going to be gone. The other one is going to be maybe only getting into his best form a bit later in the season than they need him to be. So, yeah, I certainly don't see them winning the league again. But then again, this time last year, I think we did a preview where we basically didn't even mention them at all as contenders. We just didn't mention Chelsea, and they ended up walking away with the league title.
Yeah.
So who really knows? I just think City are the best team, and they have the best squad. The other teams, anything could happen between them.
Yeah, so you're looking at three out of the other five, really.
Yeah.
For that. All right, well, look, we'll see how it goes, and hopefully we'll catch up with you guys during the season. Dion, thank you very much.
Cheers, Andrew.
Ken, thanks as ever.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you very much indeed to Dion and to Ken. Hope you enjoyed that season preview. It was certainly in-depth enough. Dion is a sports writer with Joe, joe.co.uk or joe.ie. And Ken is part of Second Captains in a summer in which podcast upheaval has been all the rage. To my mind, the best general football podcast you can get is Second Captains. You'll find out more info at secondcaptains.com. They do work on a Patreon model as well, so you get a certain amount of free podcasts. But if you subscribe, you get a whole week of podcasts and some really great stuff in there aside from football as well. So thank you to both of them, Ken Early and to Dion Fanning. So we have got a game against Leicester. Some good news when it comes to the team news. Obviously, Alexis Sanchez is out injured, just leaving a gap there for someone to go, "Oh, he's fucking not." He is. He's got an abdominal injury. Some people think it's convenient. Some people think it's a precursor to a sale. My information is it's just an injury, an ill-timed injury. He was never going to start against Leicester anyway. Barely had a week of training, and now he's out for a little while. I know some people would be suspicious, but look, all I can tell you is that my information is that he is actually injured, and the club's position on Alexis Sanchez has been very, very consistent all the way through the summer. So I think we can take this at face value. I don't think there's anything suspicious. There's no conspiracy. It is just an injury. But the good news is that Mesut Ozil is back in full training. Aaron Ramsey back in full training. Francis Coquelin back in full training. Per Mertesacker, after getting a nasty cut to his eye in the Community Shield, he's back in full training. So some of the issues that we had going into this first game of the season, well, they're not as serious or not as damaging as we thought they might be. There is, of course, a big, big squad at this moment in time. We need to get rid of some of those players, of course. It's going to be the end of the month, I think, before we get rid of, it sounds awful, but it is true to a certain extent. These players are surplus to requirements, but there's not much going on at that end of the market, is there? There's not much movement really in Premier League terms between Premier League clubs, and certainly not from Premier League clubs to clubs outside of the Premier League to Europe because of wages and transfer fees being a bit prohibitive there. But I think towards the end of August, we're really going to see some movement. But we have got to concentrate on our game tonight. We've won one in our last seven opening games of the season. That is a poor record and one that I think we need to overcome. Whether it's a psychological barrier or something else, I just don't know. You could point to a couple of seasons where we weren't properly prepared and paid the price in terms of results. I don't think we're found wanting in terms of preparation this year. Even if I do think we need a central midfield player, we've got a big squad. We've got a very big squad. So I don't think it'll be down to lack of preparation, but we've got to get the focus right. We've got to get the approach right. We go into the game in relatively confident form, having beaten Chelsea in the Community Shield. But can we get rid of this opening day millstone from around our necks, or opening evening millstone as it's going to be? I very much hope so, because it would be great to get the season off to a good positive start, because after Leicester we've got trips to Stoke and Liverpool. So it is a tough start to this season, and I really think we need to get ourselves going for everybody's sake, for the team, for the fans, just for the mood in general. It would be fantastic to get off to a winning start against Leicester tonight. As ever, we will have a live blog for you on arseblog.com. You can find out more details on site. We'll have all the post-game stuff, match report, goal clips, stats, player ratings, everything else. We'll have that over on Arseblog News, so join us there. Hope you've enjoyed this very first Arsecast of the brand new season. Let's hope it's the first of many that we can do in a good mood, because I think I'd prefer that, wouldn't you? Yeah. Alright, James and I will be here on Monday with an Arsecast Extra, looking back on everything that happens to Arsenal and over the first weekend of the Premier League season. Please do join us for that. Remember, you can subscribe to the Arsecast on iTunes. You can find it in your favourite podcasting app. Just search for Arseblog or Arsecast. If you want to give us a review, that would be fantastic as well on iTunes. It helps us. It makes us feel all special and warm inside. And what better way to get the season off to a good start than a nice review on iTunes? And, of course, 3 points and Jamie Vardy looking particularly unhappy. I'd take that. Wouldn't you? I think you would. All right, catch you on the next one. Until then, have a good one. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for being here at Piffle and Minge Auction House. Our final lot of the evening, a very unusual one, a job lot of footballers. Now let me start the bidding. I've got Kieran Gibbs for £5 million. £5 million for Kieran Gibbs. Do I see any hands for £5 million? Kieran Gibbs, Kieran Gibbs, Kieran Gibbs, £5 million. £5 million, Kieran Gibbs. I will throw in a Lucas Perez and drop the price to £4 million. £4 million. Anybody give me £4 million for Lucas Perez and Kieran Gibbs? Kieran Gibbs, Lucas Perez, Lucas Perez, Kieran Gibbs, £4 million. £4 million. Do I see any hands? I don't see any hands. I see a lot of people looking at the floor, not even any feet. £3 million. £3 million. And we've got Matthew Debussy, Kieran Gibbs, and Lucas Perez. Anybody? £3 million. £3 million. £3 million, £3 million, £3 million, £2 million, and I will throw in Carl Jenkinson, Jenkinson, Gibbs, Debussy, Perez, anybody with £2 million, £2 million for these four footballers, £2 million, Chuba Akpom, and I'll take it down to £1 million, I'll accept £1 million, anybody give me £1 million, £1 million, £1 million, £1 million, £1 million, £1 million, anybody give me £1 million for these footballers, Jack Wilshere, and I will give them all away for £500, anybody with £500, £500 for Jack Wilshere, Kieran Gibbs, Lucas Perez, Chuba Akpom, do I see £500, no, £500, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, £400, Sir, what will you bid for these four footballers?
Well, I haven't finished this here cheese sandwich. So, if you're willing to take the cheese sandwich for all those footballers, I can put them to work on my farm. Cheese sandwich?
That is a rather unusual offer, sir. But sold to the man with half a cheese sandwich.
It's got a bit of pickle on it, too.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.